So I'd like to start, just recollecting this phrase on metta and mindfulness, and with our thoughts we make the world, just to kind of keep that as a reflection for us, see if that's true for us. So I'd like to share a story about a man who I find it's a very inspiring story of transformation. And this man's name's Lanier Phillips. Lanier Phillips was an African-American born in Georgia in 1923. He died in 2012, and he was a sailor. So about 10 years ago, he came to Victoria, and he spoke there. And June and I went to hear him speak at, I think it was at St. Anne's Academy. And since he was a sailor, he was being honored, and the Naden band was there, so it made it a bit more of an occasion. But the highlight was hearing this man speak kind of very simply about his own life story. So he, as I said, was born in 1923 in Georgia, and into an atmosphere of hatred and racism. His parents were sharecroppers, not too distant in the past, were ancestors who were slaves. And so he recalls, he said he recalled his grandmother telling him not to look a white person in the eye, or this was when he was a child, don't look a white person in the eye because he'd either could get beaten or possibly lynched for that. He described that there was no school in that area for African Americans, and they actually built a school, and then the Ku Klux Klan burned the school down. So he did manage to get some education by staying with an aunt, I believe, in North Carolina, but he saw very little options for his future. Apart from becoming a sharecropper like his parents. So that's, it's hard for me to even imagine that kind of circumstances. So he saw an opportunity, and he, in 1941, he joined the Navy. So World War II. But he didn't find that much relief in that situation, because in the Navy, in the armed forces, there was a lot of racism, as he described it. So he was posted to a ship called the Luxton, and there were some African Americans, but they were relegated to things like shining shoes and serving food. So he related that in 1942, this ship left Boston heading north with two other ships, and they encountered severe storm conditions, severe winds, waves, and basically they, I think, got off track and were around southern Newfoundland, and the ship was being battered by waves, and eventually the signal went out to abandon ship on life rafts and trying to get to the coast of Newfoundland. And he described how he was with his other African American sailors, and they were afraid to get into a life raft to go to shore because they thought they were not safe on shore, that they might be beaten or lynched on shore. That was kind of their mindset. But finally, Lanier Phillips got on the last life raft. It was terrible conditions. He did eventually make it to shore. He was in very rough shape. He covered in bunker oil. He was freezing. And some other some others had made it to shore. But it was a very difficult kind of terrain. Now, meanwhile, the people in Newfoundland in this small town called, the town is called St. Lawrence, were alerted to the fact that there was actually two ships floundering and abandoning ship. So they made their way. It was very difficult to get down to the shore. They had to come down a cliff. So they assembled whatever ropes they could get, and this was in the night, and made their way down to meet the people coming in from these ships who had managed to make their way to shore. But they built a fire to try to warm the sailors who made it to shore. And so Lanier Phillips made it to shore. He was in very rough shape, hypothermic, covered in oil, injured. And he was being helped by these people from St. Lawrence, from these men who had risked their lives to come down this cliff. And they managed to get him up to the top. And there was some women of the village were helping as well, and they took him in, and he was being helped by these women. And he was kind of coming in, so he was describing this in his talk, he was coming in and out of consciousness, and he kind of saw these women, these white women, and fear came up in him because this was a very difficult situation for a black man to be with white women. This was very dangerous. He thought, you know, he could get killed for that. But I think he gradually realized that kind of the situation was different here, and where he expected maybe to be harmed coming ashore, he was not. He was helped, and his life was saved. They cleaned off the oil tried to warm him up from this hypothermia, treated his wounds. So this was a transforming experience for him, that he got a different perspective than he had ever experienced in the past in growing up, that he was not being harmed, he was being helped. And so this was kind of a moment of transformation for him. And as he described it, he, at that point of him being saved, he decided that he was going to be more like these people. He was not going to respond to hatred with hatred, because he described that before that he harbored lots of anger and hatred towards white people. And he decided that he was no longer going to do that. And I'm thinking that he saw how harmful that was, and he did not want to be like those people who were filled with hatred. So it was I found it very powerful that, you know, this was an elderly man now telling his story, and he just told us in the audience that and now I have hatred for no one. Like he in his heart, he. And that came from that decision on that night. Now, he returned. He was picked up the next day by the U.S. military and brought to a base there, and returned to his old situation. So it's not as though anything changed outside of him, but he was transformed inside of himself. So I tell that story just because it's inspiring to me that someone can, that transformation is possible. And I can see that, well, if this person can do that from these terrible conditions, well, it's possible for me or for others to transform as well. And also, just to illustrate that, I think not to underestimate the power of this aspect of metta, which is non-hatred. So we're... So one thing, when I was just reflecting about this story, I thought that Lanier Phillips had this quality of metta that he developed from this very strong intention that he made, a decision that he made. And he had two other qualities, I thought, that were very strong, that that helped him in this transformation. And those qualities were a very strong resolve, because he returned to very difficult conditions. So this resolve was I think, a part of why this was successful, that this worked for him. And he had a great deal of patience as well, because he stayed in the Navy, and eventually he took, some things changed, and there was an opportunity to train as a sonar operator, and he was the first African-American to go to this training. When he went to the training, they assumed he was there to, he was a cleaner or something, and he said, no, I'm taking this training. And he then went on to have a successful career in the Navy, and you know, raised a family. He told us a little bit about his children. So I just found that an inspiring story about a transformative kind of story. And it has a lot to do with intention. So intention could be viewed as kind of the simple aim of not harming oneself, not harming others. And then what we cultivate has a lot to do with our intention. So this intention of non-harm, I think, is implicit in observing, say, the precepts. We chanted the precepts first thing in the morning, these five kind of guidelines for how we are in the world. And in the Buddha's teaching, on the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, intention comes close to the beginning after right view. So in those classical teachings, intention, right intention, is the second kind of path factor, which has included in it the intention of non-harm and non-cruelty. And so if you turn those around, that could be the intention of metta or kindness, and the intention of compassion. So that's kind of embedded in the teaching on the Noble Eightfold Path. So I'd just like now to look at mindfulness from the Buddha's teachings, his discourses, and his similes, and just from that have some different kinds of perspectives, points of view to flesh out the meaning of mindfulness. And I thought that when I was putting this together, I thought, well, sometimes mindfulness is taught as, okay, well, we're paying attention, kind of a kind of like that, paying attention without really getting involved in what we're paying attention to, just kind of choiceless awareness. And so the first aspect or perspective is kind of a simple knowing of what is going on. And the image that's given is like you're on a tower. So just kind of seeing. But then it, I was reflecting on this, and it made me think of a, well, why would one be watching? And I think that there would have to be some kind of discriminating wisdom implicit in that. So it made me think of a friend who I met at Birken who is works as a, I'm not sure exactly what the term is, but he goes up a tower and watches for fires in Alberta. Is there a term for that? Like a fire warden or something like that? So he can't just watch and that's it. Oh, there's a fire. Yeah. Presumably his job title or job description has more to it than that. To watch things arise and pass away, or so he's has to decide, oh, there's something here I have to notify the proper people about when there is a fire, so then action can be taken. So it kind of quickly went from, just in the way I was thinking, this simple knowing what is going on, is that there still has to be some action action taking place, depending what's going on. A lot of time, maybe there's no action needed. But when there is danger, then we do need to have some kind of response. So that's kind of the first aspect, is kind of a watching aspect. So the next aspect is an investigative kind of awareness. And the simile that's used here is a surgeon's probe. So if a surgeon is investigating, say, a wound and wants to know if there's some kind of foreign matter in there that might need to come out, they use this probe. Now, presumably, I don't know the details of this, but one is trying to find that out without causing more harm, but trying to get more information. So that's investigative awareness. So we might take some quality like aversion and do some investigation as that arises of, I think what's more useful is to investigate how it really feels in the body, like a somatic kind of awareness and feeling of that. So how does in this example, aversion feel, say, somatically and cognitively? And then the next kind of aspect or perspective is a protective awareness in looking at different ways mindfulness can operate. And so a protective awareness to collect the mind to protect from unwholesome or unskillful tendencies. And the simile here from the suttas is about a gatekeeper. And I imagine that gatekeeper, so imagine we have this walled city, that there'd be six gatekeepers around the city to correspond to our five senses, kind of how we interact with the world. And in Buddhism, there's actually they consider the mind, the thoughts of the mind, as a sixth sense. So what's the job of the gatekeeper? Here's a reading. Just as a royal fortress has a gatekeeper, wise, competent, intelligent, to keep out those he doesn't know and to let in those he does, for the protection of those within and to ward off those without. In the same way, a disciple of the noble ones is mindful, endowed with excellent proficiency in mindfulness, remembering and able to call to mind things that were done and said long ago. With mindfulness as his gatekeeper, the disciple of the noble ones abandons what is unskillful and develops what is skillful. So this, the job of the gatekeeper is kind of a protective, but also to, let's say a messenger is coming, and the gatekeeper then has to determine, is this a trustworthy messenger? The messenger has some news for the king, or is this a trickster or a con trying to get into the wall, get beyond the wall to create some problems within. So that's another aspect of mindfulness. These seem to be getting kind of more and more active. So the gatekeeper can't just kind of sit there, watch people go in and out of the walled city. That's not their job. They have to determine what's safe and what's not, what's skillful, what's unskillful. And then another aspect is reframing our perception. So we could see that practicing metta can be reframing our perception, or noticing peacefulness as compared to anger might be reframing our perception. If we're, you know, just look at the news, we get a certain perception. And there are other perceptions possible. So I thought to illustrate this point, I would tell a story that... It's a story about Ajahn Sumedho. And this is a Westerner who in the 60s went to Thailand. He's American. And he was interested in learning in Eastern religions, wanted to learn about Buddhism, wanted to learn how to meditate. And he was kind of an early pioneer in going to Thailand. And he actually ordained in kind of the mid-60s. But it was problematic because he was in a remote monastery. He didn't speak Thai. He couldn't get any instructions. He suffered quite a bit, but persevered and tried to... I think he had a little pamphlet, and that was his only guidance for a year or two about how to meditate. So he kind of stumbled along in this remote monastery. So then he met a Thai person, a Thai monk, whose name's Somai, and Somai spoke a little bit of English, and Somai was traveling to another monastery from the Thai forest, in the Thai forest tradition, the monastery of Ajahn Chah. So Ajahn Chah has become very well respected meditation master in the Thai forest tradition. So this young monk, Sumedho, wasn't sure if he should go, and Somai described how this monastery operated. So monks have a lot of rules, and Ajahn Chah was very strict about observing all these rules. But I guess with the encouragement of this young Thai fellow, this young monk, he went to this monastery and met Ajahn Chah, and Somai helped him in being a translator and getting used to how the monastery operated. So Ajahn Chah became Ajahn Sumedho's teacher. And Sumedho wasn't an Ajahn at that time. He was just a young monk trying to find his way, kind of confused young monk. So then Somai started to have difficulties just following being in the monastery, and I think Sumedho started to understand why he was so interested in all these rules, because he had a hard time following the rules. And eventually he disrobed and still wanted to live close to the monastery, kind of lived in a little hut close to the monastery, but he started drinking heavily. He'd wander into the monastery drunk. He got into all kinds of trouble and would go into town and get into trouble in town. So Ajahn Sumedho at that time really didn't want to have anything to do with him anymore. And he was having quite a few judgments about this monk who couldn't follow the rules, who stumbled around drunk. And well, he wasn't a monk anymore, former monk, come into the monastery stumbling around drunk. Was having a lot of kind of judgments and just didn't want to have anything to do with him. So Ajahn Chah noticed this, and he said to Sumedho, to young Sumedho, you know, you owe a debt of gratitude to Somai. You should be very grateful to him and treat him with respect rather than disdain. It's only through Somai he brought you to this monastery. And through that, you've received very many benefits. So Sumedho thought about this. He also got the recommendation from Ajahn Chah. When you see Somai, even if he's stumbling around town drunk, offer him respect and call him Ajahn Somai to show respect and gratitude for how he has helped you. So Ajahn Sumedho related that he did this, and he noticed that when he did come and refer to him in with respect, with this respectful name, Ajahn, still referred to him as though he were a monk, that Somai kind of stood up straighter, started to at least temporarily behave better, and maybe forgot about some of the negative things he's done and would remember more of the positive things he's done. So that, I think that's an interesting story about, we might be able to apply that in our own lives with someone who we have difficulty with. We might be able to reframe our our perception. And perhaps, you know, there's people we've had relationships with or have relationships with that it's mixed. They've helped us, harmed us, or maybe not harmed us, but in this case, couldn't follow the precepts. But by kind of focusing on this positive aspect and generating gratitude for himself, it helped Sumedho, and it helped this other former monk. So that's an example of reframing our perception. So as I said, I started to try and sort these out by more passive qualities of mindfulness to active qualities of mindfulness, where we're, say, changing our perception, determining our sense data, is it accurate, is it not, is there things like greed, hatred, delusion coloring our perception. So then I think one of the most active kind of stories or similes is called Turban on Fire. So just as when a person whose turban or head was on fire put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, earnestness, mindfulness, and alertness to put out the fire on his turban or head, in the same way, the monk should put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness, and alertness for the abandoning of those very same evil, unskillful qualities. So this got to me kind of, well, the most active. Okay, I guess this is where the expression, like, okay, practice as though your head's on fire, comes from this simile. So that is a long way from, choiceless awareness to practice as though your turban or head is on fire. So some different aspects of mindfulness. So then talking about metta, I did give the simile of the salt in the water earlier in the day, where if we have a large body of water, then we don't even notice the salt. The water's still drinkable. And that is what we're cultivating with this metta practice, is more spaciousness. So at the beginning of the day, I just mentioned the election this past week and made the suggestion that we pay more attention to non-anger rather than anger, or to be more interested in, say, peacefulness than, say, agitation, and directing our attention this way. And so by paying attention to peace in this way, we experience, it seems like it does go against the grain sometimes, and it goes against certainly the stream of our society. So a couple of days ago on the Birkin website, Ajahn Sona was replying to a comment. This was kind of a blog that someone had made expressing concern about the instability and uncertainty in America, and just noticing how this person's friends were all upset and feeling some feelings of being upset herself, and just asking for Jansona any thoughts on this or any advice. So in this blog posting, Ajahn Sona replied that, well, it is the nature of the world to be unstable and uncertain. So we should kind of recollect this from time to time so it's not a surprise to us. And then he went on to ask a question. Maybe I'll pose that question to you. Who's the most important person in a lifeboat? There's the question. Who's the most important person in the lifeboat? The guy at the tilt? Well, yeah, that's... What's that? Sorry? Yeah, I suppose. I'm the most important person. Okay, so we've got the... guy at the tiller, who's maybe, hopefully, doing some steering, I am. Anybody else?
Paddleman.
Sorry? Paddle. The guys in the paddle, yeah. So we're trying to get some help in determining where we go or how we go. Ajahn Sona's response to this question that he gave was, I'm going to paraphrase his response using a line from the Metta Sutta. So the most important person in the lifeboat, I think, is the one who is peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. Actually, he replied, the person who's calm, and then he added kindness and equanimity is more related to responding to what's going on in the world. Thich Nhat Hanh referred to this exact same thing in real life. He said, with all the boat people trying to escape in terrible conditions on boats, from Vietnam, that if one person was mindful, it would change the atmosphere on the whole boat. Because I think the biggest danger is panic from when you're in a situation like that. So I guess Ajahn Sona was, making this comparison or situation in the world. So what I'm suggesting is these qualities that are being suggested to develop in the Metta Sutta are qualities that serve us well in the world. Just a few things about the Metta Sutta. So it starts out, to me, with a kind of intention. To follow a path of peace, this is what you need to do. These are the conditions that you need to develop in order to follow that path of peace. So the beginning of the sutta kind of describes some of the various skillful things one should cultivate, unskillful things to avoid. There is the line, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, which refers to a particular teaching the Buddha gave. It's called Hiri Anotapa, which are called the twin guardians of the world. So it's a little hard to translate. So I think the best translation I've seen is an intelligent fear of the consequences of unskillful action. So if we kind of see that, oh, if I start to, you know, for example, lie, then that could lead to more lying, and I just don't want to go down that path. So an intelligent fear. So we're starting to be, I guess, fearful of the things that can really harm us. And maybe in your experience, you can think of an example when you almost said something and you didn't. And you thought later, wow, I'm glad I didn't say that. You know, that's probably a common experience. Or the other experience of saying something and then thinking, I wish I didn't say that. We probably had that too. That's hiri anotapa. And presumably with that second example, and if that comes up again, that situation, I think I won't say that. So in the actual Metta Sutta, at this point in the sutta, after kind of all these instructions about what's skillful, what's unskillful, intention, and is the wish made, the metta kind of phrase given of may all beings be at ease. Then the sutta kind of expands the field in terms of whatever living beings there may be, whether they be weak or strong, omitting none, kind of the great, medium, short, or small, seen and the unseen, living near and far away, those born and to be born. So it's basically all conceivable living, sentient beings are included in that wish of metta. Then the sutta goes on to emphasize. Well, actually, after it kind of goes through all these categories, opening up the field, it repeats that phrase: "May all beings be at ease." So then that metta phrase is repeated, and then goes on to kind of emphasize no anger or ill will at all. Like, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. So here's what Andy Olensky is a translator from Pali to English. What he writes about this is, we generally think of violence as an action, but here the sutta is referring to it as a thought or a perception. At its heart, violence is striking against something. Of course, this can be striking a living being with a stick or other weapon, but at its most basic level of meaning, we may well be striking against others much of the time when we think a critical or hateful thought about them. Even if a stick is not involved, we might be striking them with our righteousness, with our condemnation, or even with our own pride. Surely we have better things to do with our mind in this precious human birth. Then at this point in the sutta is kind of this beautiful reference to mother and child, of even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So I think this phrase, this kind of evocative image, is saying two different things. It's about the mother and the child. The mother does two things with the child. The mother protects the child, and the mother just loves the child unconditionally. And I think this protection actually refers to what was just stated previously about let none deceive another, don't harbor hatred in our hearts. And that's how we can protect ourselves and others. That's my interpretation. And then the second interpretation is that it refers to this unlimited love that just radiates out and is boundless. It has, it's kind of infinite. This is the inspiring part that, so with a boundless heart, should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. And then it says, whether standing, walking, seated, or lying down, it's like you can do this in all positions or whatever you're doing. This, we can be cultivating this quality. Free from drowsiness is one translation. I prefer a translation that just says whenever you're awake. Like when you're not sleeping, this is something one can cultivate. Then there's a line, one should sustain this recollection. So this is mindfulness. One should sustain this recollection. When in the Pali, it's actually using the term sati, which is remembering. One should remember this as an intention, and that this path leads to peace. And then this beautiful phrase: "This is said to be the sublime abiding, or the heavenly kind of place that we can live." So the last bit, five lines of the sutta are more about the wisdom fruition part of the practice of metta. So it actually describes liberation. So this text is telling us that being able to experience a state of peace is not just a matter of chance, nor is it dependent upon the will of another or the benevolence of a deity. Rather, it is something we can learn how to cultivate and learn how to practice for ourselves. And this sutta kind of describes how to do this.